Okay, thanks, Kevin. Well, I'm going to begin as it was advertised on the can, so to speak, in the latest edition of the Weekly Worker, with Ukraine and the spring offensive. I think we've got about another week to go before it sort of officially has to become the summer offensive. Quite frankly, from the beginning of this spring offensive, I have to confess that I'm utterly unsurprised by its course so far. You know, we've had a village, an empty village of, one, two, or three retaken. We've had a mile here or a mile there change hands. That's true. But no breakthrough, no dramatic movement. And that is very much, quite frankly, what you would expect. Because as we've reported, and of course, obviously, we're basing ourselves on other reports, but I think we were there. At the beginning of this story, and that is since October last year, after we saw a sort of combination of the Ukrainian offensive plus Russia withdrawing to strategically defensible lines. What's happened on the Russian side is that they've been digging, 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 putting in place dragon's teeth, putting in place mines, and not just along the front line, but deep, deep into their territory. And indeed, there's satellite images of them actually putting in, defensive works along the coast of Crimea, at least in terms of this armchair general. There doesn't seem the remotest possibility of Ukraine launching a serious attack, by sea on Crimea. As I understand it, was it a month ago, something like that, when Ukraine first established its Marine Corps, for example? So there's no possibility whatsoever of that. So maybe, one explanation for the huge defense works, this is just sort of cheeky speculation, is that maybe, one of Putin's mates got the contract for the defense works and has sort of gone overboard. I don't know, but it does strike me that what we're dealing with here is more than enough to make any Ukrainian progress exceedingly slow and exceedingly costly when it comes to personnel and when it comes to equipment. And I certainly don't dismiss, because we're getting it from both sides, reports that, and this is the first time that I've heard it, so I think this is of some interest, that we've seen the deployment and successful deployment of helicopter gunships. And we've seen that on the front line as Ukraine is advancing with its new American equipment, Bradley fighting vehicles, but also German Leopard 2 tanks. We've seen these helicopter gunships just take them apart. Now, maybe that makes good TV, it's from the air. It's not the same as seeing, a plume of smoke from a mile or two away. So I don't know. Either way, we also have reports of, the Leopard 2 being a fantastic vehicle, especially at night. It's apparently got incredible night vision and can, locate the enemy from miles away and deliver an accurate shot on them. But the precise problem is, how do you get in with these Leopard 2s in some sort of proximity of where you can do damage. I mean, if you have to go through row after row after row of these dragon's teeth, you know, which are, you know, pyramid shaped, something like 4 feet tall. You know, if you get through them, you encounter mines. And that seems to be the reports that we're getting. So no surprise, I would have thought, to NATO generals, no surprise, I would have thought, to Ukrainian generals, no surprise, to Russian generals, I would have thought, no surprise to me, you know, we're getting lots of reports of, as I said, you know, fighters killed and equipment blown up or stopped. So in that context, it's worthwhile considering the Vilnius NATO conference next month. For what it's worth, my expectation is that we'll see more pledges of more equipment coming from Germany, from Britain. But of course, what really matters is the United States. You know, that's the power that can turn Britain on, turn Britain off, according to its plan of what it has, you know, in terms of Ukraine. My own assessment is, in spite of, you know, the successful use of helicopters, I don't see the, you know, the delivery of F-16 fighters, you know, from Germany, from Europe, from America, making any decisive difference. Why? Simply because we haven't seen the decisive use of air power, air superiority from the Russian side. So yes, they sort of can sneakily put up a helicopter gunship, take a pot shot at these Leopard 2s and Bradley fighting vehicles, and then presumably scuttle back. But no, F-16s are not going to make any difference. And indeed, all the reports that I've read say that they wouldn't be deployed on the front line, let alone the other side of the front line. They'll be definitely deployed, you know, over cities such as Kiev, in order to knock down missiles, in order to knock down, you know, hit and run raids by the Russian Air Force. So no decisive breakthrough. We're definitely in a war of attrition. Just thought it was worthwhile repeating the headline of an article in this Sunday's Daily Telegraph, Tory Graph, of course. And it says, let me get it right, prepare for the Ukrainian offensive to falter. Well, precisely. Prepare for the Ukrainian offensive to falter. I actually don't think it's going to falter. I just think that it's already running out of any steam that it had. I mean, to describe this as an offensive in any meaningful sense, I think, is a bit of a misnomer. Yes, they're throwing more resources into attacks, but these attacks are producing nothing in the way of severe losses on the other side, or anything noticeable in terms of territorial gains. Okay, meanwhile, we've had a delegation from the African Union in the form of representatives of South Africa, Senegal, the Republic of Congo, Uganda, Egypt, I think that would Zambia, that would do me for the moment. We've had reports of, you know, after the third delegate from the African Union gets up to lecture Vladimir Putin that the war must come to an end. I didn't bother, you know, following the detailed reports, haven't bothered to watch the video. Apparently got bored and said, well, yeah. But it was NATO what started it. And indeed, if you look at Western reports of this delegation, they actually describe them as neutral non-neutrals. From the Western point of view, these people are not seen as honest brokers. Why? because the West, i.e. the United States, and its puppet, the Zelensky regime in Kyiv, don't want peace. It's true, Russia doesn't want peace at the present time, but most certainly NATO and the Ukrainian government doesn't want peace. I mean, their version of peace is that Russia must withdraw from every inch of Ukrainian territory. That's pre-2014. And indeed, what that would be a prelude to, of course, is some sort of version of a victor's peace, a sort of Nuremberg trial, Versailles on steroids, you know, huge reparations, and the degrading of the military capability of the Russian Federation. And perhaps it's only one option that's being considered, the breakup of the Russian Federation, not into its constituent parts, but into a mosaic of easy to control or chaotic, depending on your take, micro states. Well, given the size of Russia, perhaps not so micro. Nonetheless, that's one idea that's being actively pursued at the present time in terms of, you know, looking for agents, looking for potential actors. So things can change, but at least at the moment, they don't look like they're going to change on the battlefield. So I could imagine, for example, you know, a situation where Joe Biden forgets to put one foot in front of the other again, falls down those stairs, breaks his neck. You get, you know, Vice President Harris becoming President Harris, again, not stretching things too far, in a contest with former President Trump. And who knows what happens, but Trump could conceivably win. Then what happens in Ukraine? I don't know, but clearly something would happen. Ditto if the FSB decided to retire Putin. He's not immortal, and sue for peace. Again, I don't know. Or maybe China puts the strong arm on. Again, I don't know. But I at the moment, I think it's at that level as opposed to the battlefield. There doesn't seem to be any immediate prospect of any breakthrough. Why? Not least because the United States, while it's supplying Ukraine with enough to stop it being beaten, is most certainly determined not to become directly involved or to supply enough equipment to make a decisive difference. So quite frankly, you supply or you allow the supply of, say, I don't know what the actual figure is, but it's around about 200 Leopard 2 tanks. Well, that's not going to make a decisive difference. It makes a marginal difference, but quite frankly, you would need thousands. You know, to have to take the loss in order to make any sort of breakthrough, and that isn't seeming to be on offer at the present time. Okay, let's move on. Meanwhile, in Britain, we have our former Prime Minister breaking the ministerial code. This is not, this time, lying to Parliament, not as the BBC says, you know, Parliament upholding civic virtue and punishing Boris Johnson because he lied. If they were going to do that, they would have to not only punish Boris Johnson, but every bourgeois politician who's still alive. They all lie. You know, Boris Johnson lied, not only, of course, to Parliament, which is against their rules, but he lied before he became Prime Minister, didn't he? With this piece of nonsense that the NHS would get, what was it? What was on the side of their battle bus? Was it 450 million a month, or was it 450, or whatever the figure was, 850 million a month? I can't remember. Either way, I looked at it and went, a lie. Keir Starmer, of course, he told the truth, didn't he, when he said that he would carry on with Jeremy Corbyn's program in order to be elected leader of the Labour. No, he lied. Of course he lied. It was obvious at the time. So yeah, bourgeois politicians are professional liars. But as Mike McNair has explained in the pages of the Weekly Worker, historically, because this wasn't directly elected elected representatives, because we weren't dealing with universal suffrage, because we're actually dealing in both the House of Lords and the House of Commons, the elite, they'd agreed a rule that the elite, when you come to this place, should not lie to the elite. Something that has less and less importance. They decided to do Boris Johnson, but quite frankly, they're all at it, aren't they? Okay. So Boris Johnson, he's got £1 million job writing for the Daily Mail. I think that's pretty much a token amount. He's not going to earn his big money there. He's going to earn his big money by going to the United States, and the Daily Mail job sort of keeps his profile up. It's true that while the Daily Mail promised this is going to be a column that everyone in the world reads, his first column, I mean, I can't say I need to read it, but it was about him taking this weight loss drug. Boring. But I do think that this is Boris Johnson's determination to stay around, at least on the fringes of politics, to be a nuisance, to be a somebody in British politics. And of course, in his own head, one can imagine him thinking of himself being the modern day Winston Churchill. My own take is he's much more likely to be the modern day Enoch Powell. We wait and see. All I would say is that the reason why Winston Churchill became Winston Churchill, if you see the point, you know, going from the fringes, the outer fringes of the Tory party, was the gathering storms of World War II, the outbreak of World War II, and the insistence, believe it or not, of the Labour Party led by Clement Attlee, that they wouldn't serve under Chamberlain, Neville Chamberlain. They wouldn't serve under an appeaser prime minister. They wanted a warmonger. And Winston Churchill, although he welcomed Hitler at 33 and before that, Mussolini, had developed himself into the most ardent defender of the British Empire. And that was the point of the Labour Party. The Labour Party said we would serve under Winston Churchill because he's a determined imperialist. And that's what the Labour Party was looking for. So what you saw in World War II is Winston Churchill basically ran the war, but Clement Attlee and the Labour Party ran the home front. And what you saw is the militarization of Britain to an extraordinary degree, you know, the state control of everything with American aid, the mobilization of a huge percentage of the population directly into the armed forces. And of course, the British Empire drawing on its human resources also to fight that war. And not only, of course, with the white dominions, but also with the Indian army. Okay, so there's a lot of talk, a lot of chatter in the what used to be called the Fleet Street press about the Tory civil war. Is there a civil war of sorts? Yes, there is, but at least in terms of my thinking about it, I think this is a civil war about after the general election. And this is the expectation, at least by me, I would have thought by most Tories now, most commentators looking at, you know, Boris Johnson resigning, looking at the expected Tory defeats in by-elections that are going to come, looking at the mortgage crisis that's just about to hit Britain, and one can carry on down the list that the Tories will be defeated in the next general election and defeated badly. And it's under those circumstances, at least you could imagine a Boris Johnson comeback. But of course, there are all sorts of other people, younger people, that will also be positioning themselves as sons or daughters of Boris Johnson. Whether they've got his personality, that's a different question entirely. Anyway, let's move on. We've got news in. It could change tomorrow, and we need to be acutely aware of that, of some sort of talks. I mean, the last article that Yasmin Mather wrote about Iran, from my memory, it was a couple of weeks ago, and that was basically saying there aren't any talks between America and Iran, and don't expect any talks this side of the presidential elections. And now we have a deal is close to being done. Well, again, in my mind, that makes sense from an American point of view. It makes sense from an Iranian point of view, but sort of type idea. It's far enough away, I suppose, from the US presidential election, that if it was done soon, the novelty will wear off. But from an American strategic point of view, I think it would make sense. From an Iranian point of view, suffering under sanctions, and who knows how many sanctions would remain, how many would go, it makes sense. But also we need to understand that Iran, at least the regime, needs an external enemy. It needs that threat in order to keep the lid on discontent at home. But from America's point of view, with Saudi Arabia playing uppity, with sanctions on Russia, these are the two world's leading oil powers, with no, you know, immediate prospect in light of some sort of deal with Venezuela, another big oil producer. Okay, the United States is near enough self-sufficient, but from an American point of view, you could see at least why they'd want to do a deal with Iran. On the other hand, we also have a rapprochement going on between Saudi Arabia and Iran, under at least the initiative of China. So the world's changing, you know, with the Ukraine war. You know, you cannot look at Saudi Arabia anymore as a mere puppet of the United States. It has its own interests. China has its own interests. Meanwhile, of course, you've got a crisis government in Israel, at least with you know, a good number of people in that government, definitely, and maybe the prime minister himself, looking for a war with Iran. And so while we can talk about perhaps the possibility of peace this week, we could also talk about the possibility of war the next, because these talks could break down. They could come to nothing. And then the United States can go from a situation of not allowing Israel to strike against Iran's nuclear facilities to unleashing it and letting it loose. Now, whether Israel could do Iran's nuclear facilities from the air using a bunker buster, I don't know. I mean, I've read up about bunker busters, and my God, they can penetrate deep, deep, deep through concrete. On the other hand, we suspect that Mossad has got plenty of agents buried away in Iran, and we know of past sabotage acts. So maybe they don't have to use bunker busters. Maybe they can carry out some action from within. They will know all about it. I know nothing. I'm just speculating. But the point I really wanted to get over is we shouldn't simply see peace and war as opposites. They are, but to use a phrase, they are dialectical opposites. And war is a continuation of peace, and peace is a continuation of war. And the absence of war then leads to war or peace, But we shouldn't just view them as, well, peace good, war bad, because war leads to peace and peace leads to war, because they all want a different sort of peace, don't they? Okay, talking about that, we have Antony Blinken at the moment in China, meeting his opposite number. My take on that is that the United States wants to calibrate its, how should we put it, its resistance to China very carefully. It doesn't want a premature clash with China. It doesn't want China, throwing its weight fully behind Russia. I mean, note, maybe they're supplying, military, overalls. Maybe they're supplying army helmets. They're certainly supplying Ukraine with drones, but they don't want to supply them. But maybe they would supply Russia with those drones. Remember that most of the drones that Ukraine is losing, ironically, are manufactured in China, and they're losing. The figure that they gave out the other week was 10,000 a month. Now, these drones aren't expensive. They really are a few hundred dollars, maybe $1,000 a piece. So they are cheap. Either way, the point I'm making is that China isn't supplying Russia with tanks or aircraft, or, as I understand it, even shells. That could change. And the United States, I would gather, doesn't want that to change. And therefore, they want to manage their differences at the moment. But that shouldn't blind us to the United States's long-term aims. And nor should it blind us to, from China's point of view, there you are. They're reuniting their historically recognized country. Okay, you've got Tibet. We can get into an argument about that. But there's no argument about Macau. There's no argument about Hong Kong. And there you are, over the water, there's Taiwan, Formosa, call it whatever you will. Everyone says that this is one territory, even the United States. And of course, those of us who are old enough will remember it was Taipei that represented the whole of China on the Security Council of the United States until we saw the Mao-Nixon rapprochement and all of that changed. And so the United States changed its position to one of, as I understand it, strategic ambiguity. Nonetheless, what we saw is Beijing represent the whole of China. So there's no dispute, including in actually Taiwan itself, that there's one China. There is a minority that takes a different view, but that is the view. And therefore, the question from China's point of view is about reuniting their divided country. And at the moment, it's the United States that represents the biggest obstacle to that. Okay. In Britain, we have, I don't know the details, and on one level, I think it's very good that we don't know the details, but we've had the prosecution of a mother of three kids prosecuted for using abortion pill, 32 to 34 weeks into her pregnancy. The law says it has to be within 24. And she's been prosecuted and not only found guilty, but sentenced to 28 months in prison. And she's, as I said, not only got three kids, but she's got one of the kids has got special needs. Now, the idea of locking someone up because of this, I personally find an abomination. I would have thought that, most judges, you would hope under those circumstances would be humane and say, well, don't do it again. It's not good for you. It's not the right thing to do, and let her off with a warning or something along those lines, given the law. So no, what we've got is a sentence. And the fact that this is under 1861 legislation, some sort of legislation of the protection of, you know, the body or something like that, well, to me, is neither here nor there. Either way, my view would be that therefore the legislation needs to change. Now, of course, that's a dangerous thing to do at the present time, looking at the United States, where we see the overthrow of Wade versus Roe, where we see states rolling back on abortion rights, of where we see an assertive right wing in the Conservative Party that could easily make restrictions on abortion into its cause, certainly after a heavy defeat in the next general election. Nonetheless, in our draft program, we're absolutely clear. Of course, we want plenty of advice. We need to have a decent NHS. We need to have a decent pregnancy service. But ultimately, we put forward the position as a matter of principle that it's up to the woman herself what she decides to do. Of course, she needs advice. Of course, she needs help. But she is the one that ought to be, you know, where the buck stops on this particular question. Not a judge and not a doctor. Okay. Another question, migration. Again, we've seen the abomination of this fishing ship. Go down. We don't know how many people have drowned. It could be 400, it could be up to 750. There are pictures of this ship crowded completely from end to end, from stern to, I can't remember my nautical terms, from bow to bow, from stern to whatever. Either way, we also are told that, you know, below deck, including in the refrigeration sections, there were women and children. And the survivors are mainly, I think, entirely young men. I think that's the reports. And we have 78 found, 104, excuse me, 104 rescued, 78 so far. Found dead. I mean, who knows how many. We get into all sorts of stories about the Greek Coast Guard. I don't know. We'll find out what the truth is. You know, was there an attempt to tow this ship back? We also know, and I think this is the more important thing now, that we have a Coast Guard, both in Greece under a right-wing government, but especially in Italy under a right-wing government, that basically turns a deaf ear to ships in distress in the Mediterranean. And so we have less and less patrols. And certainly when a ship is in trouble, in Italy's case, we have a no reply policy. And so the figures that I've got, we're not talking about science, we're talking about estimate, is that since 2014, and I presume that's with some sort of home minister in Italy or some prime minister in Italy, some new policy, I don't know. But either way, the date that I've got is since 2014, the estimate is that something like 20,000 people have drowned in the Mediterranean because their ship has capsized or sunk or whatever. The case happens to be. Now, from a Marxist point of view, fundamentally, in terms of where we are at, while we can call for there to be change in terms of the situation that's pushing people to come to advanced capitalist countries such as Western Europe, Britain, the United States, and that's something we should do. We need to blame interest rates, you know, We need to blame structural adjustment programs. We need to blame neoliberalism. We need to blame kleptocracies. But fundamentally, where we can really make a difference is here. And that is the response of the labor movement. And our approach is not simply to say that every migrant is a deserving refugee that is fleeing intolerable political persecution and therefore, deserves our sympathy. Some are of that. There is absolutely no doubt whatsoever. But my guess would be that the majority are what is called, not a fashionable term, but I think that is the reality, what is called economic refugees. And from our point of view, what the hell is wrong with an economic refugee? You know, if you're young, if you're dynamic, and if you're living, using a euphemism, in a shithole, what is wrong with getting out of it and trying to have a half decent life? I understand it perfectly well. If you're in Ireland, for example, in the middle of the 19th century, and people around you are starving, what the hell is wrong, from getting a boat to Liverpool or Boston? What is wrong, from not wanting to starve slowly to death? You ask the question, there's your answer. But how should the labor movement in countries like the United States or Britain or France or Germany, how should they respond? Well, our response is that people who come here should have citizenship rights, after a certain period of time and a short period of time. So we're not talking about every holidaymaker, that turns up at Heathrow and you hand out citizenship to them. But we are talking about people who live here ought to have citizenship rights, the right to vote. But we're also going one further, is that workers should have the right to join a trade union. And we mean by a trade union, an effective trade union, not an ineffective trade union as we have at present in Britain with, one wave after another of anti-trade union laws, but effective trade unions, but also to join a political party that is committed to transforming Europe into a socialist Europe. And that can make a real difference when it comes to conditions in Asia, the Middle East, Africa, Latin America, by spreading the flame of socialism to these countries. And then to begin a situation of the reconstruction of the world economy in the interest of all inhabitants of the earth. And so, yes, of course, we're in favour of people mixing with each other, people visiting with each other. But I don't think it's a healthy situation of where you get millions of people being forced by their conditions to leave their homelands, to leave their loved ones, to leave, the land and the culture and the language that they know. So, of course, we want the intermingling of people, but in a real sense, mass migration, that I've described in the 19th century, in the 20th century, in the 21st century, is the result of a barbaric system. Okay. What else? This is one that might put the cat amongst the pigeons. Michael Gove, Tory minister of what at the moment? I don't know what he's minister of. He's been minister of so many damn things over the last few months. I don't know. Either way, he's one of the, media-friendly faces that the government put up on TV and, the Sunday round of political programmes. And what he's come out and said is that next week, fulfilling a pledge in the 2019 Tory manifesto, that produced them a landslide, they're going to introduce legislation banning local authorities from putting in place boycott, disinvestment, and sanctions against Israel or any part of Israel, including the occupied territories. So local authorities will be barred from that. Why, according to Michael, is because this stokes up outrageous anti-Semitism. And of course, if you asked him for an example of it, I suspect he would point at the Labour Party, because, you know, nowadays that is beyond dispute. We all know that the Labour Party was overrun with anti-Semites. As it turned out, of course, the vast majority of these anti-Semites, like 99.99% of them, weren't any such thing. What they were and what they are is anti-Zionists. That's the point. They're against the Israeli Zionist project of colonizing, you know, Palestine and dispossessing the Palestinian people and imposing an exclusivist regime on that territory, and by implication, ethnic cleansing, ultimately, against the Palestinian people. Anyway, the point would be that we've seen this campaign and the devastating impact that it made on the Labour Party. It basically wiped out the Labour left and left what is called the Labour left basically whimpering without having anything coherent to say, almost about anything at all. So the so-called socialist campaign group of Labour MPs, all 30 of them, doesn't come out and say anything on the Ukraine war, doesn't say anything, even when it comes to, you know, the purging of fellow members of the socialist campaign group itself, you know, such as Diane Abbott. I mean, yeah, I disagree with what she said, but it, you know, when's her case going to come up before the kangaroo court? What about Jeremy Corbyn? When's his case? Well, we all know with his fate, he's not going to be allowed to stand as a Labour MP. Who knows what will happen in the general election? He could win. I would want him to win. But let's not forget that the purge began under Jeremy Corbyn, and Jeremy Corbyn was complicit in this campaign. And indeed, in order to appease the right, what they wanted to show the world is how they'd speeded up this witch hunt and the expulsion of people who clearly weren't anti-Semitic, but on the contrary, were anti-racist and principled in their own way, left-wingers, you know, like Jackie Walker, Mark Wadsworth, and the list goes on and on and on. Lastly, what's the time? 44, that's good timing, so it won't be long. It's more or less a year since in Britain we've had the beginning of what has been called the strike wave. And it is a strike wave, there's no question of it. But why is it a strike wave? Well, in good measure, it's a strike wave because what existed before the strike wave was historically low levels of strikes. And so this is under conditions of where the workforce, at least compared with my youth, is something like twice or maybe even three times as big. So my memory was of a workforce that was something like 12 million. I can remember it going up to 20 million. Today, it's around about 30 million. Now, the trade unions, meanwhile, have got weaker and smaller and more confined. So, yeah, we've gone from virtually nothing to something. And that was extremely welcome. And only an idiot, at least on the left, wouldn't welcome such a change. But of course, there were those on the left that didn't look at things in their context and you know, in serious terms, were telling their rank and file, either out of cynicism or naivety, I'm not quite sure which, that with this strike wave, Britain had entered into a revolutionary situation And we basically stood on the cusp of a revolution and the working class coming to power. So you saw all sorts of nonsense, you know, about campaigns that just disappeared, such as, anyone remember Enough is Enough? You know, but I do remember the article that we published by an American comrade saying, here is the Bolshevik party in Britain and we should emulate it. Well, God help us. But that comrade wasn't alone. And that's the point I'm really making, that what we had on the left were all sorts of different groups promising their own comrades that very soon, you know, the Tories would be falling and we'd be facing maybe our February, but inevitably then our October. Now, the strikes are continuing, and we have news of more strikes, for example, to come on the railways. We have news of more strikes in education. The teachers' union, the NEU, the biggest teaching union, is announcing strike days. We have the UCU, the universities union, announcing strike days and boycotts of marking. We have the BMA, British Medical Association, junior doctors announcing more strike days, and it goes on and on and on, because what the government is doing is stonewalling where they've got any control over employers giving pay concessions. They are trying to block it. So we have pay offers, 5%, but this is under conditions of where we've had 10% inflation. Okay, it's down to 8-point-something inflation. Either way, these pay rises are actually pay cuts. And of course, what we have with taxation levels is an awful lot of workers falling into new higher tax brackets. And we also have interest rates going up. So anybody who's got a mortgage or who's renewing their mortgage is really going to be screwed in the next year or so. That's just simply where we are at. And so we need to see these strikes in the context of workers resisting pay cuts. This isn't the same sort of strikes as we used to see in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, of workers making substantial advances in their living standards. And that was because of an ongoing capitalist boom, but also because of the power of the rank and file, because of the power of conveners and shop stewards at a workplace level. Now, that power was broken, not by Tory legislation, but the connivance of the labor bureaucracy with a labor government. And what we had is the development of, you know, employment tribunals. And instead of these, you know, a sacking, how would you have dealt with a sacking in the 1950s or 60s? You would have gone on strike, and that dispute would have been settled, I would guess, either within minutes or maybe an hour, and didn't appear on the official statistics. Now it takes a year, 2 years, 3 years. And as far as those back in the workplace, the lesson they've learned isn't that the particular individual who was wrongly sacked has been vindicated. What they've learned is fear, and that they can't turn to their trade union to defend them, that their employers will discipline them and they've got no recall. That's the lesson. Anyway, the point I'm making is that these ideas that we were just about to, you know, leap into the realms of Russia in 1917 clearly were untrue. And I just thought, as a, again, a little, you know, sober minded anecdote to that sort of heady brew, just looking at the largest, it might be the largest union now, I'm not sure, but it's certainly the largest public sector union in Britain. And that's a union called Unison. which organises, for example, local government workers. Here, under these conditions of strikes, of new highs of industrial action, what we've seen is the left, which only a short time ago had a majority on the executive committee of Unison, lose that majority. Unison was characterized by the bureaucratic staff and the general secretary being right wing, but the executive being left wing. So some sort of civil war inside Unison has been going on. But in spite of pay cuts, in spite of the failure of the Unison leadership to get the government over the negotiating table and stump up some sort of pay settlement that ensures that the membership don't actually see a deterioration in their living standards, what we've seen is either the abstention of left-wing voters or an increase in right-wing voters. I don't know, but I'll simply put this argument forward, that the argument of the right wing will be that strikes, when it comes to government, don't work, right? We haven't seen the government cave. There have been concessions, but we haven't seen the government cave, even when we've seen coordinated or elements of coordinated strikes. So the right wing, at least in terms of one line, they'll be saying is, look, we need to be sensible. We need to be moderate. And we shouldn't be doing anything that will embarrass Sir Keir and the front bench of the Labour Party when it is on the verge, when it is on the cusp of defeating the Tories in the ballot box, forming a government, and Sir Keir and his front bench will be a lot more reasonable when it comes to pay negotiations than the Tories, who at the moment not only are stonewalling, but are threatening the trade unions with even more draconian anti-trade union legislation. Sir Keir has pledged not to implement, indeed, if the legislation goes through, to abolish that legislation, which imposes a higher threshold of voting and minimum service levels and fines on trade unions that don't deliver minimum service levels. In other words, trade unions that don't scab on their own strikes are going to be fined under the latest legislation. Anyway, I'm putting that forward, of course, not because I'm in favour of the right wing. I'm simply saying that the idea of the left, that under these circumstances, things can only go to the left, as almost it's a law of nature, is fundamentally mistaken. Because, of course, what we've seen with the Unison left is no attempt to embarrass Sir Keir Starmer. So, for example, these left comrades, when it came to Diabert, when it came to Jeremy, they abstained. They didn't vote against. So we can get into all sorts of arguments about it, but just note this, that even the critics, so for example, the Socialist Party of England and Wales had previously four members of the Unison executive. They now have one, and they have one from the black section. So they lost all three members. Now, these were people who are criticising the conciliation of the left. So I'm simply making the argument that there's no automatic correspondence between an upsurge in strike action and political consciousness. Of course, political consciousness amongst some grow, but it doesn't mean that the right is disarmed or anything like that. Anyway, that's all. Thank you, Kevin.